Behind the Bite podcast is part of a network of podcasts that are good for the world. Check out podcasts like the Full of Shit podcast, After the First Marriage podcast, and Eating Recovery Academy over at practiceofthepractice.com/network. Welcome to Behind the Bite podcast. This podcast is about the real life struggles women face with food, body image, and weight. We're here to help heal, inspire, and create better, healthier lives. Welcome. Well, hello, everyone. So today's show is focused on the topic of pain, which I have actually wanted to have on the show for some time, but due to a variety of reasons that I don't need to get into, that's just never happened. And so I'm really excited for today's show. You know what? I cannot tell you how many times I've heard patients over the years tell me about the pain that they've experienced in their bodies. And there are all sorts of pains, like chronic pain, pain from an injury due to recovering from an illness, surgery. The sources are endless. But regardless of the source, the experience of physical pain is just, it's never pleasant or welcome. And the ways in which pain can impact someone's life, they're numerous, they're vast, and they're often very significant. And I also find that people, especially in larger bodies, tend to blame themselves for their pain and often erroneously believe that it's their weight that either caused or is exacerbating their pain, especially if it's in areas like their hips or their knees. And so often it really frustrates me, but people are denied relief from their pain because they're not allowed to have surgery for some reason. I'm not sure what that's about. It really frustrates me. You've probably heard me say this on the podcast before. I don't understand why people are told they need to lose weight to get these surgeries. And you know what happens is then they start to believe that they can't get relief from their pain when that's just not the case. And so for many others, living in a body that hurts, regardless of size, it can be exhausting on so many levels. And it totally makes sense to me that anyone who's in pain, right, we want relief from it. So I also understand why so many of the patients who come to see me who have chronic pain also struggle with eating disorders, because you want to numb out. And maybe food is a way to comfort yourself when you're feeling pain, or when your body's feeling out of control, like you can't control the pain. You know, eating disorders, as I've talked about on here before, it's one way to try to control something when your life or your body feels out of control. So anyway, I could go on and on here, but I'm definitely not a pain expert, or someone who helps people on a daily basis who have chronic pain or would help people to overcome pain. But that's why I have invited Donna Karen, or as she's known, quote unquote, DK Ciccone, to come on the show today. She is a certified Pilates instructor who helps people in pain improve strength, mobility, and well-being in a weight neutral environment. She's also trained in pain reprocessing therapy through the Pain Psychology Center. And having begun her own journey with chronic back pain as a young teen, she's been exploring ways to help herself and others regain the joy of movement for decades. After 20 years in the health sector, DK left a corporate career to follow her passion, later launching Movement Remedies, a chronic pain-focused Pilates studio in Boston, Massachusetts. Her first book, You're Meant to Move, A Guide to Conquering Chronic Pain, Increasing Stress Resilience, and Reclaiming an Active Life, was released in December of 2023. All right. Well, DK, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Excited to be here.
So, you know, as with most of my guests, I just, you know, love people to share a little bit about their own background, their history, kind of how you got to where you're at today. So I'm wondering if you're okay sharing a little bit about your personal history and how you got into the place in your career where you're at.
Yeah, I'm happy to. Thank you. So my, I guess, confusion about my body probably began at a young age. I think most women can probably say the same thing. I was obsessed with dance from the time I was 8. And very quickly learned that my body did not fit, you know, the standard dance body. And so from, you know, at least 10, I knew that like I had to constantly be thinking about shaping my body a certain way. And at the same time, I also had a father who had really high cholesterol. And so we had a pretty restrictive diet inside the house, you know, to kind of support him. And I now see how that my parents were also having disordered relationships with food of their own, like that I was not aware of at that time. But around the same time, around 13, I experienced my first really severe lower back pain in the middle of a performance, which sent me down this path of cycles of really debilitating low back pain that like nobody could really explain. And, you know, I weight cycled throughout my teens and 20s. And it was like I was either on something super restrictive or I was, you know, no holds barred, like going nuts with everything and putting everything in my mouth without even like feeling it go down, you know, that kind of unhealthy, really detached feeling. And it really wasn't until around COVID where I was having, I'd had a really bad pain flare up in my low back. And I was also on what was now the last diet that I was on. And I was becoming so obsessed with the food, like management, you know, packaging it in the start of the week in the little colored cubbies and making sure it was the right portions and everything. And it was like all I could think about. I couldn't think about my work anymore. I was very distracted. And I also developed like pretty severe like GI issues, like slowing down of my GI. And I must have just reached a place of really frustration that led me to a series of books. So Anti-Diet is Christy Harrison's book. And then Body Respect by Linda Bacon, and then obviously Intuitive Eating. And I just started consuming all of these books because I'm like, life can't be like this. Like I had just turned 40 at the time. And I'm like, am I really gonna be spending the rest of my life trying to shape my body like unrealistically into a thing that everyone else is expecting it to be? Because of course, as you know, we all know, like as beyond 40, then you start getting all kinds of other like superficial things that you're supposed to be doing to yourself, as if trying to be smaller and be in smaller jeans is like not hard enough. And I think I just reached this state of like, surely my human value is more than whether or not I can fit into a certain size of clothes. And so I just kind of like voraciously read all these books, and it got me to a place where I realized, okay, I need to stop this. I need to stop obsessing with my calories, you know, like even thinking about some foods is good and some foods is bad. And it took years. I mean, I want to say 3 years of really trying to process that, coming in and out of it. I did seek out help from an intuitive eating coach. And what surprised me is that alongside going through this kind of shedding of diet culture conditioning for 20 years, I was actually making huge strides in my chronic pain relief. And that was when I really started to appreciate that having an upbringing of learning to ignore hunger signals, you know, basically teaching my brain that my body's, you know, signs were not to be trusted, set me up for a chronic pain experience later in life. And that became sort of my working hypothesis as I opened my own pain-focused Pilates studio in 2022. And I wanted it to be explicitly a non-fitness, like non-judgmental, non-diet talk environment where people could come in the body that they're in today and not feel like they were going to be even, it's not even going to be a question about whether or not you were here because you wanted to lose weight. You were here because you wanted to feel good in your body. And most people I work with are in pain. And I've seen the story play out over and over again, where folks who have been told that they need to look differently, either because, you know, people believe that's how doctors have told them that's how they're going to deal with their pain, or because they just had the experience of being a young person in our society and just felt that pressure to live in a certain body all their lives, that they were the same folks who could not anticipate pain flare-ups in their body because they were just so disconnected. And so, you know, my work has become really about, in addition to just teaching people movement and helping them feel safe and good in their bodies when they move, but also helping get that connection back, because that was what I needed to do in my own body. I had to sit with the feelings that were causing me to feel like I needed to control my life through food. So sitting with those feelings and recognizing them, I mean, I now realize that my anxiety issues and kind of self-esteem issues were very much tied to the initial flare-up of pain when I was 13. So in so many ways, my diet culture journey, my chronic pain journey have been weaving in and out of each other since I was a teenager.
Well, that's, I mean, and I love that you're bringing this topic, and I've wanted to talk about chronic pain or pain for the longest time, because I think we don't really think about disordered eating or eating disorders, body image and pain is tied together. I don't think it's really talked about at all, actually. I certainly haven't had a show talking about it. I've wanted to, like I said, for the longest time. And I do think there's a huge population of people, at least I've had on my caseload for the years I've been doing my practice, where that is a huge discussion, where like, to your point, people are coming in pain. They want to move, they want to exercise, they want to live a life without pain, but they are being told, to your point, like from medical doctors, like, you have to get into a smaller body, you have to lose weight in order to maybe get a knee replacement, get a hip replacement. But it's really hard to do what they're asking you to do, which is move more, exercise more if you're right. It's this notion of like, something's wrong with your body. And you can't get the help you need or get out of pain unless you get into this smaller body. So even not the societal pressure, but this other pressure, right? Like, you can't get help unless you're in a smaller body, almost like something's wrong with you, right? You must be unhealthy. And like the shame or the blame of like, oh, well, it's, and even the mentality, and maybe you can tell me a little bit about this too, the mentality of like, you know, your pain is being caused or it's getting worse because you're in a larger body. I hear that a lot too. Like, oh, if I could just lose the weight, I wouldn't be in so much pain.
Right. Well, and I mean, people believe that, the story they tell themselves, even if they haven't been told that by their doctors. And I think some of it may have to do with the fact that, you know, as women, when we enter kind of changes in our hormonal journey, there is often weight gain associated with it. Now, I'm not a clinician, but at least from what I've read, the weight gain is tied to the fact that your body's trying to produce more estrogen, and that's one of the ways in which it does it. So it's going through a perfectly normal process, but and pain is often a symptom of the perimenopause change as well, increased joint pain and other things that are going on. So I think for women in particular, we're like feeling differently for many reasons. And then we're like, the only thing that's different when I look in the mirror is my shape. And so we are drawing this correlation that just isn't really there, that there's so much going on behind the scenes. And I think it's problematic that we don't talk about menopause in the medical field, you know, and it's also problematic that we're continuing, that folks are continuing to diagnose or prescribe weight loss as a way of dealing with pain. And I have never seen anyone come in here and say that losing weight had any effect on their pain. If anything else, it made them like, you know, hyper vigilant about their body and even more angry about their body. And like, what we're trying to do here is heal our relationship with our bodies. And that often leads to way more relief than telling your body another message about how it's not living up to your expectations, or it's not, you know, like you're giving this sense of a lack of safety. And if you think about the fact that pain is, in essence, a signal from your brain that it's interpreting a threat to your body, it's interpreting danger of some kind. So if we're just sitting around in our body and we think, and we're just constantly giving our giving messages from our brain about how our body is not a safe place, like surely that has to affect the way that we're interpreting the environment around us.
No, that's well said. And, you know, so you know, from what I heard you saying, you have a studio, you work with people who come in with pain, and your philosophy on exercise is much different than I think most people, right? Because I really, I'm upset always when I hear like exercise is tied to food or food intake or exercise. The purpose of exercise is weight loss versus like, I'm curious, how would you say, what would you say to somebody the purpose of exercise is?
Well, first of all, I try not to use the word exercise. I think it's a loaded word. So what I say is that, and that's why my book is called You're Meant to Move.
Awesome movement. Okay.
Is that, you know, evolutionarily, we were not like meant to sit at desks all day and be and be sedentary. It's just not really how our bodies have evolved over time. And so it's inherent in us as humans and humans on this earth. We have, there's a desire and, a, and an aptitude for moving our bodies. And so I would say your body wants to be moved in all directions some amount of time every single day. Now, that's going to be different for everyone. It could be 5 minutes. It could be an hour. It really depends. But really detaching that from the guilt associated with, and I definitely had like a movement guilt thing going on. Like I had to punish my body for whatever I, for my food choices. And so I really try to be persistent about that here and make sure that folks, when they come in, are not using that language about, you know, why they're moving their bodies and reminding them that like, this is to bring joy. And I'm more about the mental health benefits also, because, you know, it's for, especially for folks with chronic pain or chronic conditions or just old, like as we get older, like life is hard enough as it is. I want you to like be able to shut out what's happening outside in the world that might be disappointing and be able to come in and just like embody your vessel and experience it and just and let it be an experience of moving mindfulness. You know, we know that mindfulness and sitting, being able to be present in our bodies is good for our mental health, is good for our emotional state. And so why not do it moving? And so we just try to find movement that feels really good. I would never try to like prescribe a certain amount of time or a duration, although I do say do something every single day, even if it's just like moving your ankles, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And when folks have come in and they have a really bad flare up, you know, they're often will call me and say, okay, I've had a bad flare up today, so I'm going to cancel. And that's the moment that I'm like, that is when you precisely need to be in here, because that's when your body needs to be kind of re-engineered to recognize that whatever's causing your flare up is not really a dangerous thing. Unless, of course, you like just fell off of a ladder or something, in which case, please go get a doctor. But, you know, for the most part, a flare up of our chronic pain has everything to do with our environment. And I've never had somebody come in here and not in a, in a flared up state and not be glad, even if we're just like using the myofascial release balls or we're doing some gentle stretching and mobility. And like in general, the chemicals and all the positive things that happen inside your body when you move it are for just far outweigh like any other thing as far as I'm concerned. And so I really believe that moving your body every day is the number one health promoting behavior that we really need to be focused on more than anything else.
Well, I think your perspective is much different, because I do hear all the time people have one idea of movement, and it's, you know, going to the gym, like exercising. And I don't know, maybe you can speak to this too, but I hear, oh, I can't go exercise because I'm in pain, or I can't go exercise because I'm too large, or I need to lose weight before I can go to the gym or start working out. And so what I'm hearing you say is, no, if you're in pain, come start moving. That's not a hindrance to movement. Actually, that's going to help. Movement's going to help your pain versus like what other people say is like, I'm in too much pain to move.
Yes. So, I mean, I think there's two things there. First of all, I do believe that we are failing as a fitness industry. I am technically in that bucket to make movement spaces accessible to all bodies and to help them feel welcome and I think there's a lot more we can do there. I mean, what does that say about our environment if people feel like they need to lose weight in order to show up to move? I mean, that's really sad. Movement is supposed to be a thing that, you know, we want everyone to do because it's good for their health. And I mean, I know I'm very well aware I'm speaking from a Pilates perspective in particular. Pilates studios are notorious for having, or like on Instagram with like the little teeny outfits and like flipping themselves upside down. And so there's definitely like a, you know, an association between looking a certain way and being allowed to show up at a Pilates studio. And that's problematic. And then the second thing I would say is I think we just have some outdated passed down wisdom that rest is best when you're in pain. And much of the medical like research has advanced beyond this. I mean, even like if you sprain your ankle, they want you like moving like the day after. I mean, it's really rare that you want to sit still. I mean, apart from like a severe acute injury, like in general, if you like talk to folks who have even hip replacements, they get you out of that bed fast, you mm-hmm. know? So, and then think about that as a trauma to the body. So, I mean, really the rest is best thing is like, is dead. I mean, that is not the best way of dealing with pain. And what it ends up doing is, if we're thinking again, pain is your brain saying, you know, we're in danger. If you feed into it and stay still, then you're kind of like reinforcing that, like thought pattern, you know, when you really want to be actually like putting yourself in a position to say, actually, I'm safe now, like body, like it's everything's okay. And again, it doesn't have to be like a run. I think that's the other problem. We like put it in this little box. And I really think we're only going to have a positive relationship with movement if we find the thing that lights us up,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I know some folks just are like, I hate exercise. I would really love to dig into that kind of thing because I think some of that comes from traumatic presidential fitness tests and having to like hang on the bar with everybody looking at you, you know, and we've all been there. Or, you know, it comes from feeling unwelcome in certain spaces or having like a certain expectation, like if I don't do this many things, that means I'm not good enough kind of thing. And I really believe that like everyone has something that they enjoy doing that involves movement. They just might not be counting it as movement.
So someone's listening and they're going, okay, I'm in pain. I can't move. Like I've tried, I hate like, but when I try, because it is so painful, like, you know, come on, you guys don't get it. Listening to this, like, what would you say to somebody?
Movementremedies.org. Go ahead and come and find me. No, I mean, I would love to talk to a person who feels that way because I believe that, I mean, mm-hmm. I believe that we can find something that feels good, mm-hmm. but I would just, I would tell that person to make a list of 10 things they enjoy doing that has some kind of form of movement mm-hmm. and just try them. Try every single one of them. Try walking in a pool. Try putting on music and just, you know, walking around your house. Try sweeping. I mean, maybe you like a clean house and that brings you joy. I mean, there are things that are moving your body that mm-hmm. are not quote unquote exercise. If you are super like severely having joint pain, then I guess we have to have to the point where you can't move at all. And then we probably have to have a joint replacement conversation. I mean, I know that's a scary thing, but mm-hmm. I've seen lots of folks recover splendidly from joint replacements and go on to go like skiing and hiking in New Zealand and, you know, doing all kinds of things with a joint replacement. So, you know, if genuinely you have something going on in your body that is making movement not possible. I mean, obviously if you have a medical condition, like, Let's get that taken care of. But I still believe that you should be able to find some parts of your body that you can move that will still bring joy. I mean, I've had completely foot-focused movement sessions myself, just from like trainings I've gone to. And it's like, it still gives you a little endorphin boost, feels really good in your body to move your feet around to kind of give them a self-massage. Mm-hmm. So there, I really believe there's just lots we can do. And I would challenge anyone who says that they like legitimately cannot move their body if they don't have like a condition that would make that the case.
So it sounds like it's just really rethinking movement because, you know, the toxic diet culture, as I know we and you were talking a little bit before we hit record, you know, I think it really does set the mindset for people about what is movement and what quote unquote counts as movement mm-hmm. Or the purpose of it even. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Why people do it in the first place. Like, I think a lot of people think they need to do it for certain reasons, and that's just demotivating.
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly research around for, you know, women as we age, we definitely need, I mean, men too, but we should be doing something that is resistance related, something that involves picking up a load. Mm-hmm. Because we want to keep our muscles strong and our bones strong and so on. So I would definitely, you know, advocate for doing something that involves lifting, but that could also be reorganizing your closet. But I, you know, apart from that, like as far as I'm concerned, it's about feeling good in your body. And like, how hard is that? That's not a small thing. That is a really hard thing. Like if you were to pull people off the street, I think I would be like, I would have to pull a lot of people in here and ask them if they feel good in their body before I got a yes. So like that in of itself is a triumph. It's a triumph to feel good in your body, to feel worthy in your body, to feel deserving of feeling good in your body, to let go of, you know, all of the outside stresses. I mean, it's the least that we can do is honor this physical thing that we're in. It deserves it. We deserve it. And I think sometimes we're so caught up in, you know, success and external validation and all these other expectations that we forget to care for the very thing that we're inside of. It's so easy to delay it until tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Well, but just, if you want to be independent until old age, you got to move.
Mm-hmm. Well, just as you were talking, I was just thinking, what does that even mean to feel good in your body? Is it like an emotional thing? Is it a physical thing? Like, is it all of it? Right. Because I think to your point, so much, at least, you know, a lot for women too. And unfortunately, I think it's becoming more so for men as well. The message is change your body. It's never good enough. Right. Hate on your body. Even like, I hate that message, but it's like, you know, constantly needing to change it instead of embracing it and like appreciating it, take care of it. Right.
Yeah. That new year, new you, like as if there's always something new that needs to happen. Like,
right. Or like you brought up menopause, embrace the changes that are coming instead of like thinking you're doing something wrong, that the changes are coming and naturally occurring. Like combat it. Right.
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like you're out of control. Your body's out of control. You did something. You need to prevent this, or you need to like change it up, or aging, right? Like aging occurs, but you know, if you do age and you actually, you know, look your age, you're doing something wrong, right? It's like this virtuous thing. It's like you look younger than your age. Like, oh my God, they look amazing, right?
It's a luck of the draw, really, in this game of things. It's genetics. Like there's very little that we can do about that. And yet we have so much value to offer. Each of us has inherent value just by being alive. Like we don't need to work for it. We don't need to strain for it. We don't need to prove it. I think it's just very hard to sit with that, to sit with who we are, to sit with our feelings. And so we chase after external things. Mm-hmm. And so movement becomes part of that. It becomes part of like shutting up the signals that are, you know, that are telling you that your job is stressful or you're in a toxic relationship or, you know, you need to address your disordered relationship with food. I mean, all those things show up as a sense of lack of safety, and they show up differently in every body.
Mm-hmm. And I know this isn't maybe your place of expertise, but do you think that there's a tie between the eating disorders and the chronic pain so much that like, if somebody's not nourishing themselves well enough, it does have an impact on, say, the way their body can heal or their pain? I'm just curious.
I mean, I would about that. I would have to imagine that is the case. I mean, I haven't worked with you know, a lot of folks in that situation, but certainly your nervous system is the source of pain. Your nervous system requires recovery in order to balance between the parasympathetic and the sympathetic. Parasympathetic is associated with digestion. You need nutrients in order to feed your body and to operate at top, you know, capacity, as well as sleep. So, I mean, you know, nourishment is a huge part of giving your body the tools to recover. So, I mean, I would have to imagine that is significant. I mean, certainly when people come in looking to move and they haven't, you know, eaten that day, I mean, I keep little bags of snacks in here, like making sure that folks have always eaten, because sometimes they let their day get away from them, but they definitely move differently than if they, you know, if they nourish themselves.
Right. Because I mean, there's a few avenues I'm thinking about with this in terms of like disordered eating, right? People are in pain, kind of numbing out, or, you know, using food as a coping mechanism to not feel the pain. Because I can imagine having chronic pain is something that like people don't want to feel. They don't want to be in their bodies. And so like turning to food can be one way to really distract and get comfort. So I don't know your thoughts on that too, or who you work with, if that's something they're dealing with?
100%. I mean, I'm not sure that people would tell me that that was what was going on, but I can tell you that that's how I felt. Mm-hmm. You know, I would reach for food to kind of try to numb all the time. I mean, that was a significant part of my journey with food. Mm-hmm. And then to turn around and be told, you know, you need to lose weight. It kind of perpetuates this like cycle of thinking where if I'm hurting, it's my fault. And I'm doing it to myself, which is so not a helpful narrative. I mean, for anybody, I mean, mm-hmm. pain is happening because your nervous system is functioning correctly. And it has been, you know, it has evolved to let you know that if you stick your hand in a hot flame, that it's bad and that you should take it out. Right. It's just like a sign for action. It's just that sometimes it thinks that everything's a flame. So, you know, then you're like telling yourself, okay, well, I can't be trusted, or, you know, I'm the reason it's to blame, or I'm the reason that I'm in pain and my doctor, you know, the whole thing about not doing operations on folks until they lose weight just absolutely sends me like over the moon, like bonkers, because I've had people, you know, hear that and be warned in advance and yet they're like suffering through the joint pain, you know, to try to stay mobile. And, you know, I don't see any data around that. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a minute, because that is one thing that really infuriates me. I hear this all the time, like, oh, I need a knee replacement, my hip's bad, whatever. And, you know, it's like I'm getting refused the surgeries because I need to lose X amount of weight, or I'm being told, like, you know, it's my fault that I'm in so much pain because of my size. And I think people believe that, like, oh, if I just weighed less, my pain wouldn't be so much. Like, you know, if I was in a smaller body, my knee wouldn't hurt so bad, or my foot wouldn't hurt so bad, or my hip wouldn't hurt so bad. And I don't know about you, but like, I know people in any shape, size, body, weight that like everybody's got knee pain, like hip pain. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know where this narrative came from, but I'm like, people have pain.
Yeah. So what really changed my perspective on this was doing some research on the connection between running and knee osteoarthritis. Mm. And so there's actually several studies that show that your cartilage can actually thicken with moderate, like regular running, and that there is no connection between the progression of knee osteoarthritis and running. And similarly, they found that your vertebral discs could have increased thickness as a result of moderate running. So basically, the body is adaptable, right? And so when I read that, I was kind of like, okay, so the force of a human being running on their knee, right, increases significantly the weight that is being like put on that joint. So you're going to tell me that just like a person in a large body walking is going to make your knee osteoarthritis worse and your pain worse, but like some guy running, you know, is not? Like, that to me was incongruous. Mm. And so I often will share that with clients if they're getting that feedback, or if they feel like, oh, it's not going to take or something, like I have to wait until, you know, until I'm in the right body. But I mean, we all know that just like trying to purposely change your body shape, it just doesn't work. It's just not how we're, it's like me being like, you know what? I want to have green eyes. You know, like I'm going to effort for green eyes. If I do 100 pushups a day, I'll have green eyes. I mean, it's that ridiculous. So, I don't know why it's like taking the medical institutions so long to adapt, like understanding that and getting all that stuff out of their behaviors. But mm-hmm. I always think about this book called Switch, because in my non-Pilates life, I did organizational change management, and it's about behavior change. And they talk about how they came up with a non-invasive arthroscopic way to do heart surgery. Because the old way is like literally sawing a person's sternum in half, right? It's pretty mm-hmm. barbaric. But they were finding that older surgeons who had been doing the open heart, like sawing way for so long, were like refusing to take up the arthroscopic version of it, because that was just what they were comfortable with and that's what they were used to. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like that's, you know, that's when it comes right down to it, we're talking about human change and human behavior change, and that's really difficult. you know? Mm-hmm. So that takes a really long time. And I think that the medical system is just not catching up. Like, we've all decided BMI is nonsense. We all know it's nonsense. Like, there's all this research about, you know, the strength of your cartilage and your ability to adapt and so on. And yet we're continuing to push this stuff. I mean, the other thing I bring to my clients is the research around all the people who have degenerative issues but are not symptomatic. So there's been tons of research where they like pull people off the street, put them in an MRI machine, and they're like, that person has a herniated disc. That person has lumbar arthropathy. That person has, you know, major arthritis, and they don't feel anything. So it is possible to have changes in your tissues inside your body without pain. And if that's the case, that means that we can do so much. There's so much hope for us. I mean, to me, that's a story mm-hmm. of hope about how we can rethink how we live in our body and make it a safe place, and we can find joy in movement, and then we can have a little fulfilling life and leave all the other crap behind. I mean, that's my hope.
So I'm just curious, how do they explain that? Like, the people that feel the pain from those degenerative diseases and illnesses versus the people that don't, they have any idea what the difference is?
So in the studies that I'm quoting, they were only interested in seeing if there were asymptomatic people. So all they did was report on the results that they found all kinds of stuff going on inside people's bodies without pain. Now, I would say that the Pain Psychology Center, where I did pain reprocessing therapy, Alan Gordon has his book, The Way Out, and he quotes a lot of those studies as well. And so he is really the expert on this, but they go into the neuroplastic pain, which is essentially pain that exists despite the fact that the healing process in your body is done. So we know that there's no structural reason for you to have the pain. And they have been able to use somatic tracking and, you know, similar coaching behaviors or practices to help people basically recover 100% from their pain symptoms, particularly with the low back. That's one of the most common ones. Up to 80% of people are expected to have low back pain at some point in their lives. So they've been able to use that kind of exposure therapy really as a way of unlearning the pain connection, where your body, your brain has connected, like maybe sitting in a chair for a long time with back pain, or you know, figuring out what are your triggers in your outside world. Like, you know, do you have, again, a toxic relationship, or your mother-in-law is visiting and that's very stressful? Or, you know, a lot of times people, they're like, oh, I twisted my ankle today while I was walking, so that must be why it's hurting, but never consider the things that are going on in the environment around them. And that's the biopsychosocial model of pain, which now understands, just like we now do with social determinants of health, which now understands that the things that lead to health outcomes or a low pain status have a lot more to do with what's happening all around you than what's happening actually inside your body.
Interesting. So I'm curious if people are kind of going, oh my gosh, this sounds really interesting. Like, do you talk about this in your book at all? Like,
I talk about it a little bit in my book. So, I mean, I come at it from the perspective of movement. So I like to apply Alan Gordon's, you know, exposure therapy approach using movement as a tool. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people have a fear of falling. Mm-hmm. And so movements that conjure up a fear of falling will often be painful. And so I try to create movement programs that help people challenge that fear, either by creating balance or lack of stability, but in a safe way. So like, I'm there. And then little by little, they get more confident and then find that their pain is improved because they're no longer fearful of that thing. Mm-hmm. I would encourage folks to read The Way Out. I mean, if this sounds interesting to them, it's a very digestible book. Mm-hmm. And that's really the source of that stuff.
Okay. Yeah. Cause I think people are always trying to find, like, why am I in so much pain? Like, always maybe even trying to blame themselves, right? Like, mm-hmm. It's my weight. It's my this. It's I'm not doing this right. Right. And even like, I've heard so much lately, like, oh, I'm eating inflammatory foods. I have to eat non-inflammatory foods. Right. And like, to the point of like, that sparks up eating disorder stuff too. It's like the good food, bad food. I have to eat so restrictive again. And that just kills me. But Are you hearing this too?
Yeah, I have heard hearing that a little bit. I mean, I do have folks with autoimmune diseases who, you know, maybe have been given a specific diet, but I'm always questioning like whether that's really helpful, because then they'll come in berating themselves for being bad. And I just don't like that language. I don't like moralizing food. Yeah. I mean, maybe it's because of my evangelical Christian upbringing and I get kind of twitchy, but yeah, it's just like food is nourishment. Food is calories. Like food is energy. So, okay, you made a choice. And like, is that really the reason that you're, and then I'll ask like, was your pain really worse? It's like, well, no, I just feel bad, you know? So I just, I'm always asking questions, like trying to understand that. I mean, again, it's, I'm not a clinician. And so I'm not really in a place to kind of tell people, well, that diet is crap. But I mean, I do ask questions of sort of like trying to understand, is this a real thing that's happening? Or is this a story that you're telling yourself? And, you know, can we kind of get to the bottom of that story? Because I hear that a lot about the kind of, you know, avoiding certain things, you know, and they believe that those things are tied to how their symptoms show up. But I'm also kind of like suspicious, because it's like, how comforting is that? This idea that like I can control my symptoms if only I control my food, or I can control my pain if only I do XYZ. It's almost like comforting to feel like it's your fault, you know, because then it means you can do something about it. Like if the problem is that my environment is stressful, now what do I do? Right. Like if the problem is outside of me, it feels much scarier, I think. So I think people also, you know, grasp onto those things, and they start, you know, in a placebo type way, like assigning value to things changing in their behaviors, because they want so badly to believe that the pain can be controlled with a very tangible activity.
Right. Well, I mean, that just is the crux, the whole thing about eating disorders, right? It's a control thing, right? So, I mean, that's my fear for anyone listening. It's like, please, like, don't fall into the trap of like having to control your food just to try to control your pain, because that's right. The whole thing, right?
Well, right. And then it sounds like that orthorexia or whatever, or you're kind of, you're purifying, like, you know, if only I eat like just organic flax seeds and, you know, like, you know, that also, again, it's just, it whiffs of diet culture. It just shows up. It's insidious. I mean, as other guests have pointed out, and as I also talk about in my book, it's just because you're a much more compliant consumer when you believe all these things about yourself. That's the bottom line, you know? I mean, I think Naomi Wolf said it great in her book, The Body Myth, of years ago, you know, women are much easier to control, and they're not going to cause so much trouble if you can just make them believe that they need to constantly be obsessing about the way they look.
That's a horrible thing.
Gosh. Yeah, it's terrible. It's terrible. But I mean, there's some underlying systems in our society that need to be dismantled. I was not expecting this conversation to go there, but here we are.
That's a whole nother podcast.
It's a whole nother podcast.
I'll be back. Well, yeah. But I mean, I love the fact that like so many things are intertwined, and when you look at the big picture, it is about all these things, like to your point that like, why aren't things changing? Why are things, they are all connected, right? To your point, like BMI and the belief that like, if you're in a larger body, your pain's worse. Like, oh, you're not going to get approved for the surgery, or like exercise is one thing versus another. And I think people do need to start challenging a lot of the things they believe. Because I don't think there is enough of that, right? I think people just blindly believe everything they hear, things that they've grown up thinking. And even about their pain, right? What do they believe about their pain? Why they have it? Like, what's the cause? What can they do about it? I don't know.
And yeah, and part of it is the fact that nervous system research is just really exploded in the past 10 years. And I just think it's like a new frontier that's just getting a lot of activity. So I would definitely encourage people to go to Google Scholar or whatever. And like, when you hear something, like find research for that. I mean, we can educate and equip ourselves. I was telling you before we started recording that I'm technically obese on the BMI scale. And so I have been, without asking for it, I have been offered a weight loss drug twice by two different female physicians because they saw my chart and they're like, oh, you've gained some weight. I'm like, yeah, I'm at perimenopause. And, you know, both times I said, okay, thank you. Am I pre-diabetic? I thought my blood work was actually pretty good. And they like went back and checked, like they hadn't even checked my blood work to like see if I was a good candidate for it. And that's a life-changing drug. So, you know, I'm not sure what's going on there, but one thing, you know, going into perimenopause has taught me is that like really the system is totally unprepared and ill-equipped to handle like all the things that are happening. So I've just really just tried to arm myself with more research. And I hate to be, I'm not anti-medicine or anti-science. I mean, I do believe that, you know, I'm not trying to throw it down the baby with the bathwater or whatever, but I, you know, we know our bodies. I think we need to like listen to our bodies and make sure that we're equipped with the information that we can help us make decisions in partnership with our medical providers.
So I'm curious, like your experience hearing that twice, what was that like for you?
Yeah, it was hard. I mean, yeah, I'm still there. Like I'm not like a perfectly recovered person. Like I still have moments where I find an old picture or, you know, and or whatever. And I mean, at first I was panicking, like, is my health at risk here? Like, what am I missing? But yeah, it took a little bit of time for me to kind of, I had to have a good little pep talk, you know, to fill yourself. Like I said, it is so much effort and is so challenging just to feel good about who you are in your body in this very complicated, very judgmental world that we live in. So I think having your go-to podcasts and books and affirmations and you're having your community of support is probably, you know, probably the most important like health, you know, factor that we really need to focus on. Cause I think a lot of that got eroded during COVID. Mm-hmm. And so I had to reach into my toolbox, but that was hard. And I was like, if this is happening to me and they know what I do for a living and I'm well equipped to handle, like, you know, to defend myself, I can't imagine what it would be like for other folks who are just, you know, trusting and may not have awareness of the fact that it's even meant to be a diabetes related thing. It's not supposed to be just randomly associated with weight, you know, Slim Fast or Ozempic, you know, like it's not like that. It's way more dangerous.
Well, you know, and that, just as you're talking, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, there's toxic diet culture right there in the medical field. Like it's the presumption of if you are in a larger body or have a certain BMI, you must have something wrong with your physical health and well-being. We must give you some medication because something right. must be quote unquote wrong with you. And I'm so glad you asked, there's nothing physically wrong with you. There's no need for you to take this medication. Right. And that's scary to me, right? Because we know these medications can cause a lot of other health problems, right?
So yes.
Taking this medication could cause problems for you.
100%.
Like it could cause a state of physical unhealth, if you will, like, or you to actually get sick with other things, which is like, why would they do that? But also to shame you and make you feel bad, like to trigger some of your eating disorder thoughts and body image issues that you already had that you've dealt with, right? Like that's, to me, that's horrible.
Right.
That's not okay.
And I think it's interesting because, you know, I'm sure I have it in my chart. I've definitely told them that I don't want to be weighed like when I go there. And so like, they're not paying attention to things like that either, which is really upsetting.
Mm.
There was something else I was going to say and I blanked. Perry brain.
Well, I mean, but this is a big thing. I mean, to your point, like you're educated and you're knowledgeable, but how many other people don't even ask, like, why am I being prescribed this? Do I actually even have right. a reason for it to be right. prescribed? Right.
And I mean, I had mentioned that I had gained weight over the past year, mostly just to express, because of course I was having to fight everyone to believe me that I was in perimenopause. Cause that was fun. So I was like, well, one of the things that's changed, you know, in addition to other things is that my weight has gone up and my understanding is that's associated with perimenopause. And I had to really fight. I had to fight to get, you know, finally find a provider who would talk to me about about hormone replacement therapy to feel better. And I'm not saying that that's the cure for anybody either, but like for me, that made a huge difference in my well-being, because I was having heart palpitations and, you know, the terrible, you know, night sweats and mood swings and all kinds of things that were made better by estrogen. But like, as soon as anybody saw anxiety in my chart, you know, they were just kind of like, oh, you don't know what's happening. It's just anxiety. And I'm like, how patronizing are you? I've been in this body 42 years. How long have you been in this body? Oh, zero? Okay, thanks.
Oh my goodness. Well, I mean, yeah. I think that's a lot of things too. Like on my end, putting a diagnosis in somebody's chart of, you know, anxiety, depression, I'm always very mindful about that. Like if another clinician, right, sees that diagnosis, like, are they going to have a certain idea about somebody, or like,
yeah,
you know, are they going to like kind of dismiss some of the symptoms they're coming in with because, oh, maybe they just have depression, or like kind of look at through the lens of that versus like what they're really coming in with. Right.
Yeah. 100%. I now remember what I was going to say. She mentioned the second doctor, who is an endocrinologist, mentioned, you have really good coverage for these drugs. I'm really impressed. They cover it 100%. It was almost like it was trying to be like, get the free gift, you know, like, and that also kind of set my feelers out, because my insurer is terrible and I'm often having difficulty getting things covered. So it was like, there's also an incentive structure behind the scenes that's happening, I think, where health insurance companies have decided that, you know, obesity, air quoting, is a problem. And so they're going to manage their healthcare costs, and they think they're going to reduce their healthcare burden of services by just giving everybody Ozempic. And so they're giving it out for free, like candy, to make everybody skinny. And that is just like a very short-sighted and also very outdated idea about what causes health issues. And I think that that's part of what's going on in our system, because health insurance companies control basically what you can and what services you can and cannot get. Whereas I'm over here being like, pay for Pilates, because people come in here and they're like, I feel so much better after I come here. I wish that, you know, my insurance would cover it, and I wish they would too.
Well, you and me both, right? Like, I mean, we should honestly have another podcast, because we are getting into the realm of like what's covered, mental health stigma, right? Because oftentimes mental health isn't covered. Treatment for anxiety is not covered either. And so I'm getting like kind of riled up here going like, why is Ozempic covered? And like treatment for people to come to me is not covered. And to the point, it's a lot of the stigma too, right? It's like, if people are in smaller bodies, they're healthier. But if people get treatment for depression and anxiety, that doesn't make them quote unquote healthier or improve their lives. And so there's a lot of areas we could go into about like ideas about what makes people quote unquote healthier, better, live better lives. Right. So anyone
is healthy?
Sorry, we're going down like lots of rabbit holes here, but like my mind's kind of ping ponging and getting really upset.
It's hard.
Yeah. So like I said, we could definitely continue. But I know you have brought up lots of things. I don't know if you want to briefly just talk about what is all, I know you've mentioned it, but what is in your book, so that if people do kind of want to learn more about you, maybe find you, that they can navigate on your social media, find your book. Honestly, if anyone's listening and like, your mind is sparking like mine is, please leave comments for this podcast and message DK and myself with anything you'd like to hear in the future. But I'd like to hear you say more about your book.
Yeah. So the book is basically like what I wish I had when I was in my 20s and my back pain really hit its peak, and how I wish I had been guided through the process of getting active again, because I had the rest is best recipe given to me. And, you know, I was really encouraged not to move my body in certain ways. And, you know, that was probably true in like the early stages of my disc herniation. But as time went on, I really needed to move my body. And so the book is set up in such a way that you can follow it as like a 13-week program if you want to do it week by week, and it takes you through the steps of what are your pain narratives? What is the story you tell yourself around pain? How did pain show up for you? When does pain show up for you? And there's exercises at the end of each chapter. So you can kind of do it week by week if you like. And then there's a whole section on, you know, how is diet culture influencing you and your pain? How is stress influencing you and your pain? And then it gets into the more specific, okay, what kind of movements do you need to be focusing on if you are someone who wants to get active, but you're coming from a perspective of having recurring pain? And so it helps. I give people a sample movement program. I have all kinds of extra resources on my website. And by the end, you should have a movement program that you enjoy and that like is aligned with your values and your heart's desires. And you can go off and do your movement program and hopefully feel better. So that is the goal of the book.
That's fantastic. And so do you have a website?
Yep.
People want to find you, social media, website. How do they do that?
Yeah. So I'm movementremedies.org is my business. DK@movementremedies.org is my email address. And movement_remedies is my Instagram handle. That's my primary social. And I have, you know, if you want a digital copy of the book, I'd be happy to send it to you if you want to shoot me an email.
Fantastic. Awesome. Well, like I said, lots of things came up today. Really love when that happens. Actually, it's great. Any last final words before we end?
I just always want to remind people that, you know, I think it's easy to get caught up in all of the things that are frustrating about the human experience, but there is so much hope actually for pain. And that's one of the things that I think is so wonderful. The more research that I've done and the more folks that I've worked with, the body is always capable of achieving a new thing, always, until you take your last breath. And so I would encourage you that, you know, pain is not a life sentence and you can find joy in your body again. So I hope that you will take that and run with it.
Fantastic. Thank you so very much for being here. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
This podcast is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information in regards to the subject matter covered. It is given with the understanding that neither the host, the publisher, or the guests are rendering legal, accounting, clinical, or any other professional information. If you want a professional, you should find one.